Genesis 18, the 19th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on September 2, 2001 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2001. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Genesis chapter 18 today. I find this chapter very therapeutic. We see Abraham in a light that shows him to be very, very noble and admirable and one that we ought to emulate. And we also see God in a light that we oftentimes don't think of God this way in the Old Testament. But he's actually very compassionate and understanding. I think we've seen that elsewhere in Genesis, and it comes out, I believe, here again in chapter 18. I'm going to look at this in two parts. I'll read through the first part and then make some comments on it, and then there's one issue that I would like to address with respect to that. Then we'll look at the second half and do the same thing. So the first section of chapter 18. Now the Lord appeared to him by the oaks of Mamre while he was sitting at the tent door in the heat of the day. And when he lifted up his eyes and looked, behold, three men were standing opposite him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the earth and said, "My lords, if now I have found favor in your sight, please do not pass your servant by. Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet, and rest yourselves under the tree, and I will bring a piece of bread, that you may refresh yourselves. After that, you may go on, since you have visited your servant." And they said, "So do, as you have said." So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah, and said, "Quickly, prepare three measures of fine flour, knead it, and make bread cakes." Abraham also ran to the herd and took a tender and choice calf and gave it to the servant. And he hurried to prepare it. And he took curds and milk and the calf which he had prepared and placed it before them. And he was standing by them under the tree as they ate. Then they said to him, "Where is Sarah your wife?" And he said, "Behold, in the tent." And he said, "I will surely return to you at this time next year. And behold, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door, which was behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in age. Sarah was past childbearing. And Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I have become old, shall I have pleasure, my Lord, being old also?" And the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh, saying, 'Shall I indeed bear a child when I am so old?' Is anything too difficult for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return to you, at this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son." Sarah denied it, however, saying, "I did not laugh," for she was afraid. And he said, "No, but you did laugh." The first issue that we have to settle is, did Abraham know that this was God who was coming to him in the guise of a man? It has been argued in some commentaries that says, yes, he did know. Why? Because the first verse says it's God. Secondly, the word that's used for when he says, "my Lord," that is a form of the word that is ordinarily reserved just for reference to God. Third, we have Abraham bowing down before these three men. And fourthly, the foods that were presented to these guests are foods that were typically used in offerings to the gods. So those four things appear to add up to the understanding that Abraham knew that this was God when he first appeared. It seems to me, however, that what fits the context much, much better is that Abraham did not know that this was God. And my main reason for believing that is because this chapter ends up being in contrast to the following chapter. In the next chapter, we have two of these same men going into Sodom. So they become travelers and guests in need of hospitality in another situation. And in this other situation, in Sodom, they are treated very differently. So the contrast is very stark. But in order for that contrast to work, it has to be unknown to the one giving hospitality that this is indeed God. These have to be just travelers. So I think that that is the case here. That's what makes the most sense in the context as a whole. And if that's true, how do we explain away the points that are made in favor of the argument that Abraham must have known that this was God? Well, the first is, in the first verse, it is kind of introductory. It is telling us as readers that God appeared to Abraham. That doesn't mean that Abraham knew from the outset that it was God. So it's giving us a preview. We know something that Abraham did not know at the outset. So as a result, when we read through, we pick up on the clues that everything Abraham does has kind of a double significance. When he refers to them as what's translated in my Bible, my Lord, the one that's usually reserved for use in addressing God himself, that same form can also mean my lords. And I suspect that that's the better translation here. But that same form is ambiguous. It can mean either addressed to God himself, special address to God himself, or it can mean address to people in whom you are in service. The bowing down. It was not atypical for someone to bow down to another person in show of respect. And here we have guests coming. For him to bow down is not out of the culture. That's something that could very well happen as a show of respect to these guests. So again, it takes on a double significance to the reader who knows that he's bowing down not to just ordinary travelers, but to God himself. The foods that are given. Abraham is giving special food to these travelers. It just so happens that those are valued foods and therefore suitable for giving to divinity. So as Abraham is scurrying around preparing these foods, there is a sense in which he is preparing offerings for God, but he's not thinking of it in those terms. So everything takes on a double significance to the reader who knows what Abraham does not know at the outset, and that is, this is God that has come to visit him. Okay, if that's the way I'm going to proceed, is that Abraham does not know at the outset. So what's happening here? It is a typical day. There's nothing special about the day. It is in the middle of the day, the hottest time of the day, and a time in which I assume in the culture that they would rest, take a time of rest so that they could work in the cooler times of day rather than in the hottest time of day. This is happening at Hebron. Hebron is a place where Abraham was frequently. It's one of the central areas of where the activity in the patriarchs takes place. And it is a place that just recently was in the news as a place of conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelites. So typical day, it's hot, middle of the day. Abraham is resting probably, resting outside of his tent. I don't know if he's sleeping or he's just sitting there, but he looks up and he notices that there are three men standing in the distance. I assume it's in the distance because it says that he ran to them. So they're off in the distance standing there. They aren't walking, they're just standing. And apparently they're standing, and Abraham reads the situation as travelers who are, they don't know whether to approach or not. They don't know whether this is some place that they can come for hospitality or not. Abraham responds, "Yes, I want to be hospitable." He runs to them. He bows down before them, and he begs them to enjoy his hospitality. Abraham is eager to serve them and help them. So for Abraham, it will be a favor to him if they enjoy his hospitality. And that's the way he sees it. They say, "Go ahead, fix them." He says, "Would you allow me to fix you a little something to eat?" But then when they grant permission, he starts running around making provisions for a very extravagant meal, actually, on short notice. He instructs Sarah to make bread out of the choicest flour. He goes and he picks an animal out of his flock, which would not have been done ordinarily. So this is an extraordinary situation. And he presents curds and milk are combined in this meal. While he's scurrying around, he tells the guests, "Take some water, wash your feet, and rest under the tree. And I'll put this thing together as fast as I can." And with no microwaves, it would have taken a little longer. Once it's all prepared, he brings it to them, and then he stands in attendance as if to serve them, make sure that all their needs are taken care of while they eat. Then they begin to talk, and they say, "Where is your wife Sarah?" Now, if he doesn't know who these people are, which I'm assuming, that must have been a shocking question. First of all, that they knew that he had a wife, Sarah, and furthermore, that they called her Sarah rather than Sarai, because it has just recently happened that God has renamed her Sarah. So that the fact that they had this knowledge must have been striking to him. Who are these people? She is in the tent. Tent walls allow sound to pass through, so she can hear what's going on. They announce to him that Sarah will have a son a year from this time. Remember in the last chapter, God had revealed to Abraham that he would have a son through Sarah in a year. Now he is coming and appearing before them, and he says it again. So presumably these are close in time because it hasn't changed, it's still a year off. When God told Abraham that he would have a son through Sarah, Abraham laughed in disbelief. But God insisted, "Yes, you will have a son." Now he's making this known to Sarah, and she laughs. The response is the same. Now, it is possible that Abraham is a bit like me in that God came to him and said, your wife's going to have a son, and he forgot to tell his wife. It's just one of those things that happens. More likely, he told her. That's big news. If he really believed it, then you would think that he would have told her. If he has told her, then she's at this point laughing because she still does not believe. So it's one of the two. Either she has been told and she still does not believe, or Abraham forgot to tell her. But her response is the same. She laughs in disbelief. The same response that Abraham had had. She is too old now to have the pleasure of having a child. She's 90, I believe. And her husband is too old. And Sarah is just thinking, this can't happen. It's the same response that Abraham had had. God's response is, why did your wife laugh? And Sarah's, and he says, nothing is, and my Bible says, too difficult, or is anything too difficult for the Lord, I think is the wording. Yes, is anything too difficult for the Lord? It actually says, is anything too wonderful for the Lord? And there's a significant difference there, it seems to me. What God is saying is there anything that is too good for God to accomplish? This may be hard to imagine. This would be a great good, hard to imagine. But is it too great for God to accomplish? And the answer is no. Sarah, then, and I assume Sarah comes out from the tent, and Sarah says, I didn't laugh. That is a very Clinton-esque kind of response. Because it depends on what you mean by laugh. If laugh requires the emission of sound, then she did not laugh. But if one can laugh without emitting sound, if one can have the attitude of laughter and disbelief without emitting sound, then she did laugh. God's response is, no, you did laugh. Regardless of the word games, you laughed. Interestingly, God, even though she lies, God doesn't scold her. His perspective is, wait and see. God had taken the same perspective with earlier towards Abraham. He did not scold Abraham for laughing. In both cases, God's perspective is, just wait and see. Now, the issue I'd like to talk about with respect to this section is this hospitality thing. Abraham was truly hospitable to these strangers, these travelers that are passing through. And I find it, there's something encouraging and inspiring about what he has done here. His generosity, his hospitality to these strangers is truly remarkable. And it is an indication of the kind of person that Abraham is. You can see from this act what makes Abraham tick. And that's what's really important in this section in Genesis. Think about the nature of hospitality. What is happening in hospitality? This is out in the desert where there is little. These travelers they can't carry everything that they need. They can't carry all of the food provisions that they might need. They can't carry all of the shelter that they might need. They can't carry all of the clothes that they might need. I'm sure they do their best to be equipped, but they can't carry everything because they're traveling. Abraham is at a great advantage with respect to them in that this is where he is settled. He has all of his possessions with him. He has a lot of food. He has a good tent. He has extra clothing, etc., etc. So Abraham is at an advantage with respect to these travelers. The question is, what is he going to do with this advantage? How will he use it? And what Abraham does is uses his advantage to the benefit, to the well-being of these who are relatively disadvantaged. That says an enormous amount about someone. We can expand this. It doesn't have to be just true with hospitality. It can be true of any kind of power. We all have power in various aspects of our life. And by power, I mean some kind of advantage. It can be political power. It can be social power. It can be financial power. It can be relational power. We find ourselves in all kinds of relationships with other human beings in which sometimes we have the advantage and sometimes we have the disadvantage. But it tells a lot about a person's character, how they use their advantages. If you use your advantage in your own self-interests, that says one thing about you. If you use your advantage in the interests of others, that says something very different about you. By nature, we use our advantages for our own self-interest. It takes a miracle for us to use our advantages in the interests of others. And that's the miracle of God entering into our souls and transforming us. And part of what he does is teaches us that he, that is God, can be entrusted with our own best interests. In fact, he is better at fulfilling our needs than we could ever be. Once we learn that and come to trust that, it grants us an enormous amount of freedom. I no longer have to be constantly looking out for my own best interests and scraping and clawing and protecting and grabbing to make sure that I'm taken care of. We can relax, allow God to do that, and that gives us the freedom then to be attentive to the needs of others and use our advantages to help others. That kind of transformation is a miracle. And a miracle that only God can perform, and a miracle that God is committed to performing in the life of every believer in time. And it's that kind of perspective then that allows us not just to be hospitable, but also to be charitable, generous, patient, tolerant, etc. And as a result then, from that perspective, whenever we are hospitable, it is as though we are serving not the stranger in front of us, but we are doing service to God himself. In Hebrews, the author of Hebrews encouraged us to be hospitable, mentioning that some have entertained angels unawares. And I think he has Abraham in mind here. That when we are hospitable to others, it is as if it was God present there with us. Matthew 10:42 says, "And whoever in the name of a disciple gives to one of these little ones even a cup of cold water to drink, truly I say to you, he shall not lose his reward." That kind of generosity and hospitality to those in need is as if it is service to God. In fact, it is service to God. Okay. I find that truly inspiring. It's something that I constantly need to be reminded of, but I would like to be that kind of person. I would really like to be the have that perspective on life that grants me the freedom to be truly hospitable, truly generous, truly charitable. Now, whenever I hear someone talk about this kind of topic, there are a couple of questions that come to mind, so I will address those as well. The question is, for instance, these people that stand on the corners when you're driving or through town with their cardboard signs, does that mean that we should always give money to those people with the cardboard signs? And I think that the answer is clearly, there is nothing particularly virtuous about throwing money at every cardboard sign. Because oftentimes what's happening is we want to feel good about ourselves, and therefore we hand money to this person, and we derive the benefit of feeling good about ourselves and nothing more. So ultimately, it is self-serving. It can be. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. In order to be truly a servant to someone else, you have to make some kind of judgment as to what would really be in their best interests. And giving money to every person is not necessarily in their best interests. It takes wisdom and judgment to determine what will really be of service to them and what is just appeasing my conscience. Those are two very different things. If we are really going to be the servant of another, we have to make that kind of judgment. What will truly be in their best interests, not just what would make me feel good. And furthermore, we have other responsibilities that all have to be taken into account. I've often thought about this with respect to picking up hitchhikers. Should you always pick up hitchhikers? Well, my practice of late has been to hardly ever pick up hitchhikers. But one of the things that I weigh with that is, what kind of risk do I bring to my family? And those are judgment calls. Those are difficult questions. I think in one situation you might answer it one way, in another situation another way, but we have to judge. That's part of living life. Hospitality is not always an outworking of faith. I mean, similar to just giving money to every person with a cardboard sign, hospitality is not always a measure of faith. I was working at the Duck game yesterday. We have a fundraiser for my kids' soccer club, and my job was at Mashofsky Center to make sure that nobody carried any beer out of the center and nobody carried any beer into the center. Why? I don't know. I was told that that was my job. So I did that. But I spent more of my time answering questions like, where's the bathroom? Where's the payphone? Where's the ATM machine? That kind of thing. I did more of that than sending beer back. But I was thinking about it. It's kind of fun to help people. And there were a lot of us doing this, and I think that was true for others as well. It's kind of fun to be helpful. I'm confident that it's fun to be helpful because God made it that way. There's something in us that wants to do the kinds of things that are good and proper. And there's pleasure that's derived, therefore, from being helpful. However, there's something really insidious about the sin that's within us. It takes every good thing and tries to find some alternate route to that good thing that is more in keeping with our selfishness. As a result, then, we derive pleasure from being a good, helping other people. But part of the pleasure is feeling good about ourselves, feeling helpful, feeling kind, feeling good, all that sort of thing. So how do you sort it out? Well, it's difficult to sort it out because we can't read our own hearts. But there are some indicators. And one of those would be, what if you get no recognition for what you've done and no gratitude for what you've done? What is your response? If your response is, what did I do it for? Then that means you are doing it for the recognition and for the good feelings. But if, even in the face of ingratitude and lack of recognition, you do it and you say, I would do it again, then it's more likely that what's driving you is you're doing it because it's the right thing to do, quite apart from the response. I've thought about this phenomenon a little bit, and I would like to think about it some more. But all of our behavior, all of human behavior, for the most part, I think, can be accounted for by God-given desires and our own perverse ways of trying to meet those desires, fulfill those desires. And as we do that, we end up performing perverse actions and involving ourselves in perverse activities. I was watching a morning show a couple weeks ago on TV, and they were talking about this phenomenon on campus, and I think it's called hooking up. I hope that's the right term. I think that's what they were calling it. And it is a new relatively new phenomenon in college campuses. And their polls show that 40% of college students engage in this. Hooking up is not entirely new, but it's become more formalized in recent times. And the way they describe it is hooking up is where a boy and a girl decide that they will engage in some level of sexual activity for one evening with the understanding that it means nothing after that evening. There's no implied commitment whatsoever. And usually it happens under the influence of alcohol. It's after people have had a beer or two, then this sort of arrangement takes place. And on this show, they had about six female college students, and they were interviewing them about this. And the interviewer was rather incredulous that they all engaged in this activity. And yet, in talking to them, none of them really liked it. They all engaged in it, and they all defended it as a good practice, but none of them really enjoyed it. And they were pointing out that among freshmen, it's most common, but as students get older, it becomes less and less common. And one of the women students described this as, these were the words that she used, a few sloppy moments for a little bit of love. And I was thinking, that's about the saddest thing I've ever heard. What's happening is, they're trying to fulfill a God-given desire, that is, the desire to be loved. They're trying to fulfill that, and they're getting desperate and reaching for anything, and I mean anything, because to interpret what's happening there as love is fantasy. So they're really reaching to try to get some sense of being loved. But we have the desire to be loved, not to be fulfilled that way, but rather so that we will appreciate it when God provides love to us through himself and through other people. We have the desire to love so that we will appreciate the love that God provides. We don't have the desire to love so that we will go out scrambling to find it and grab it wherever we think we can get it. So why is it fun to help people? I think it's so that we will derive pleasure from the opportunities that we have to help others. Not so that we can feel good about ourselves when we do things that are seen socially as being admirable actions. Okay, let's read the second half then of this section. Verse 16, then the men rose up from there and looked down towards Sodom, and Abraham was walking with them to send them off. And the Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am about to do? Since Abraham will surely become a great mighty nation, and in him all the nations of the earth will be blessed. For I have chosen him in order that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, in order that the Lord may bring upon Abraham what he has spoken about him. And the Lord said, the outcry of Sodom and Gomorrah is indeed great, and their sin is exceedingly grave. I will go down now and see if they have done entirely according to its outcry, which has come to me. And if not, I will know. Then the man turned away from there and went towards Sodom, while Abraham was still standing before the Lord. And Abraham came near and said, wilt thou indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Wilt thou indeed sweep it away and not spare the place for the sake of the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from thee to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous and the wicked are treated alike. Far be it from thee. Shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly? So the Lord said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare the whole place on their account. And Abraham answered and said, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord, although I am but dust and ashes. Suppose the 50 righteous are lacking 5. Wilt thou destroy the whole city because of 5? And he said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. And he spoke to him yet again and said, suppose 40 are found there. And he said, I do not do it on account of the 40. I will not do it on account of the 40. Then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak. Suppose 30 are found there. And he said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, now behold, I have ventured to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 20. Then he said, oh, may the Lord not be angry, and I shall speak only this once. Suppose 10 are found there. And he said, I will not destroy it on account of the 10. And as soon as he had finished speaking to Abraham, the Lord departed, and Abraham returned to his place. So God and the three men, they get up and they begin to leave, and they walk away from the oaks of Mamre, the place where Abraham's tent is. And apparently there is a place near Hebron where there is a gap between the hills, and you can actually see down to the plain below where Sodom was located. And God says, should I keep what I am about to do a secret from Abraham? That's interesting. God has decided that Abraham is going to play a key role in history from God's perspective. Perseus, who was the leader of Athens, in one of his famous speeches, made the statement, Athens is an education to Greece. What he meant by that is, Greece has a lot to learn from Athens and the way that we do things. It could be more rightly said, it seems to me, that the nation of Israel is an education to the world. That God chose Abraham and his descendants as the vehicle through which God would make known who God is and what his purposes are. And furthermore, through the descendants of Abraham, make provision for our sinfulness. So Abraham is playing a really key role in history, as seen from God's perspective. So God decides, because he is playing such a key role, I am going to give him even further information. I am going to let him have some glimpse as to what the future holds. And in this particular passage, he's going to make known to Abraham what is the fate of the wicked. Prior to this, at least in God's dealings with Abraham, this issue has not come up. But here God is making it clear that he is going to judge the wicked. And he's going to judge Sodom because of the outcry. This term, outcry, is used in contexts where the source of the outcry is oppression of those who are disadvantaged, oppression of people who are powerless. So apparently, that is the sin of Sodom. It is not taking care of the poor and the hungry. The outcry has reached God. God has decided he is going to come down and investigate to make sure that it is so, indicating that God is not rushing into judgment. He wants to make sure that this is in fact the case, and there's a sense in which potentially mercy is possible. Then the two men leave and they head towards Sodom. God stays there with Abraham. Abraham, hearing that Sodom is going to be judged, decides that in solidarity with anyone who's righteous, he pleads the case before God, they need to be spared. You cannot treat the wicked the same as the righteous. You can't just nuke Sodom and have collateral damage to the righteous. And I'm sure he has in mind Lot in particular. But Lot and his family, though they're going to die along with the rest of the people of Sodom. And that's not right. That's not the way God would do things. That's not in keeping with his values. And he pleads with God on that basis and says, surely, that's not the way you do things. So he says, if there are 50 righteous people there, you've got to save it, because otherwise those 50 people would be victims of your judgment on the wicked in Sodom. And God says, you're absolutely right. I won't nuke it for 50 people. And then Abraham gets a little bolder and tries to bring it down. It's like negotiating the price of something that he wants to buy. He brings it down, and he gets it down all the way down to 10. And God says, nope, for 10, I will not zap Sodom. And Abraham must be feeling pretty good. And he feels there's got to be 10. I mean, we know there's Lot, and he's got two daughters and a wife, and there's got to be a few others. Interestingly, archaeologically, they have determined that at least in the summertime, the population of the plains where Sodom was located must have risen to about 100,000. So thinking in just visualizing this then, let's use the duck game. There were 45,000 people in the stadium yesterday. So if you were there or saw it on TV, that's 45,000. So if we're talking half of what they estimate the summer population of that area of Sodom to have been, we're talking half. All we need is 10. So Abram must feel like we've got it. He feels like he has saved Sodom on that basis. What he doesn't realize is God would have gone down to 1. That 10 was higher than what God was willing to settle for. God was willing to go down to 1, and he, instead of saving Sodom, what he does is he saves the one righteous. Now, I realize I have dismissed Sodom's wife and his daughters. We'll talk about that later. Okay. What was Sodom guilty of? Let me see. Sodom was not, my suspicion is, Sodom was not obviously evil. If you had gone down to Sodom, you would have seen a lot of niceness, a lot of civility. I'm quite confident that that's the case. And my reason is, to my thinking, at least in historic times, one of the wickedest times was Nazi Germany. Why was it so wicked? Because it allowed such gross perpetration of evil. But in studying the times, Germany was very polite and civil. Germans are raised to be polite and civil. But politeness and civility does not change base wickedness. Those are two very different things. My suspicion is that Sodom would have seen itself as polite and civil. They would have seen themselves as basically good human beings. And yet God is saying, they should be destroyed. What was their sin? What was their error? One commentary I read described it as cynical insensitivity to the sufferings of others. In Ezekiel it says, Ezekiel is talking to the people of Judah and is likening them to Sodom. And it says, only this was the sin of your sister Sodom. Arrogance. She and her daughters had plenty of bread and untroubled tranquility, yet she did not support the poor and the needy. That's the sin of Sodom. It's that arrogance that creates an indifference to the people that are around us. It's an arrogance that allows us to not use our advantages on behalf of those who are at a relative disadvantage. In other words, the arrogance of Sodom was the opposite of the hospitality of Abraham. So they are being judged for their selfishness. My wife was telling me about an article she read in the paper a few days ago. And I hope I get the details of this correct. There was a woman in Seattle who was contemplating suicide and was about to jump from a bridge in Seattle. And because she was there about to jump, it interrupted traffic. So traffic backed up, and you can imagine Seattle has a problem with traffic on the best of days. But now we've got a situation in which something is holding up traffic, and so it's really backing up. And apparently there were some motorists who were yelling at her, "Jump and get it over with." Another incredible act. I mean, a horrendous kind of act, but think of the perspective that betrays. That woman is an inconvenience. Jump, die, so that the traffic can start moving again. That is the wickedness of Sodom. I think that's exactly what it's talking about. There is a phrase in, I think it's in Matthew 24, where Jesus is talking about the end times, and he uses a phrase, I don't know if I've probably mentioned this in here before, but I'll probably mention it again. It's a phrase that is in the back of my mind all the time because it's so haunting. Jesus says, in the end times, the love of many will grow cold. And I think this is what it's talking about. It's talking about that attitude that would say, jump and get it over with. You're an inconvenience in my life. Just end it, get out of my way. I wish you never existed so that my life can go along, can proceed without interruption. That's the very opposite of the attitude of Abraham. Abraham is seeing those travelers. This is an opportunity. These are not an inconvenience. This is an opportunity for me to serve. And in serving them, I'm serving God. Okay. Questions, comments?
Question is twofold. I was thinking this morning, and I'm not sure if there is any progression, if there's any validity to the inquiry, but it seems from Genesis, coming through history, God initially is very present on the earth and with people. Mm-hmm. And if this is true, where Lord here actually means Lord, right, that's an example of it. And then, right, as time goes on, he appears in a burning bush and then through prophets.
Right.
I wonder if that's the case. And also, I wonder if Lord here could mean not Lord, but as so much as a prophet or somebody... where Abraham knew it was the Lord, knew it was God, but it wasn't God per se. It would be like much like a prophet, much like an angel, much like some representative of God himself.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if by the end of this section... By the end of the section, Abraham clearly knows that he's speaking to someone who knows the mind of God with respect to this issue, at least. Does he know that it's God himself? I don't know. And in fact, is it God himself? I don't know. But it is someone who knows the mind of God that has appeared before him and is a spokesman for God. With respect to your first question, I think that's very interesting, and that's something that is fairly recent in my thinking, and that is this. I think from the biblical record, it is the case that God has decided at certain times to be more involved and obvious, apparent in his activities within mankind, and at other times, virtually transparent. And he has very consciously done that. Up until the flood, as I read Genesis, God was quite present in human affairs and quite visible. But after the flood, he drew back. And only on selective occasions to individuals does he make himself apparent until the Exodus. And the Exodus becomes another time that God really reaches into history and becomes obvious, not just to one or two people, but to the world as a whole. And we know that people knew about what happened in Egypt, because it tells us that when the Israelites went into the Promised Land, they had heard the stories. So it was widely known what had happened. So there is an instance where God really reaches into history and makes himself obvious. Another time when God does that is with the coming of Jesus and then with Pentecost. It's another time that God reaches down and makes himself visible in his activities. And I think there is one more time yet to come, and that's the end time when God will do that again. And the end times will be much like the bringing of the Israelites out of Egypt, in that God's activity will be very obvious. But in between those periods when God is reaching into history, he does selectively make himself known to individuals. But other than that, he's quite transparent. Why does God do that? I don't know, but I'm becoming more and more convinced that that is the way he has chosen to act.
As usual, you've challenged some of my previous thinking about a passage, which is usually a good thing. Those of us who grew up in Sunday school are pretty familiar with this story. Mm-hmm. It's kind of an interesting one. Mm-hmm. I've always taken the word outcry to be something like, universal sexual deviance with gusto or something. And I haven't studied the word, so I will certainly take your word for the fact that it means something to do with the outcry of one who is being oppressed. Could it not still refer perhaps to the outcry of those victims of such rampant sexual deviance rather than generally economically depressed or something like that? It just, the whole story, the way it goes, the response of the angels to the treatment by the men of the city, trying to drag them out so that they can have sexual relations with them. And then the response to that, they use the same word again. It just, it's kind of jarring to me to think that it's anything but sexual deviation.
Well, I think the charge, God's charge against them is arrogance. That's what we're told in Ezekiel, and I take that seriously. But arrogance can have a lot of manifestations. What he's talking about, when it uses the term arrogance, I'm confident what it means is self-absorption. I will look out for my interests and my interests alone. That's the deep-seated perspective of the citizens of Sodom. And what happens when one has that perspective is they are overcome with a kind of insanity. In the pursuit of gratification, of fulfillment, people will end up doing very self-destructive things as they become more and more desperate. They resort to more extreme kinds of remedies, and they become increasingly counterproductive. And I think that the homosexuality is just one manifestation of that kind of heart. It's just one of many. My guess is you would have seen a whole array of activities that would have been manifestations of that hard attitude.
It's just interesting that none of the others are mentioned. And one phrase really struck me. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old. All the people from every quarter. It just seemed to be an attempt to characterize that as being a universal problem within the city.
But notice what's happening here. I would see this. Abraham is not just hospitable. Abraham has this heart attitude that God will take care of my best interests, so I have the freedom of looking after the best interests of those people that God brings into my path. So we are just shown a snapshot of Abraham, but I'm confident that that snapshot indicates that he is also charitable, generous, patient, at least to some measure. In Sodom, we just get one snapshot, but what they're doing betrays a hard attitude that had to have manifested itself in a lot of other ways as well. So we've got the contrast, and I'm confident it's the contrast of the whole spectrum of behaviors, not just hospitality versus homosexuality.
Thank you.
Yes.
How do I say this? I'm wondering if you can offer me some hope, because I see in myself someone who is hospitable but has the wrong motivations, and someone who is less than compassionate towards someone else's pain if I'm inconvenienced by it. Usually I can mask it pretty well. But after years and years of being a believer and wanting my motivations to be godly, I find they still are not.
I could say the same thing. And God is gracious. And that's one of the things, I haven't seen that side of God in Genesis before, but it is interesting to see how gently he's bringing Abraham along. And I think we can count on the same gentleness, in a sense, from God. Patience and gentleness. That God is committed to us as believers to bringing about that kind of transformation. It will only happen in part in this life. But the fact that anyone wants to be that kind of person is progress. The fact that anyone has the eyes to see that they are not that kind of person, those are already signs of a miracle that has happened. And I take great solace from that. That I just hope and pray that God will do the radical surgery that's necessary to make the transformation of my soul such that I am that kind of person. And therefore, it is incumbent upon me to do whatever I can to take the steps to perform generous and hospitable kinds of acts, all the time hoping and praying that God is working through that and indeed is transforming me to make me the kind of person that does that as a matter of course. Let's pray. Father, I may be wrong, but I suspect that what Debbie has said is true for each and every one of us. You work in strange ways, and oftentimes what you do is make clear to us where we come short, but it's difficult to see where any substantial change has taken place. But we have to rejoice in that fact in and of itself. And I pray that you will continue to help us to see ourselves clearly, to see ourselves for who we really are, rather than some illusion that we have created, some lie that we're living. Help us to see who we really are, but go further, take another step, and transform our souls. And give us the encouragement that we oftentimes need, that you are indeed working in our hearts, that you are indeed making us new creatures. And give us the hope, the confident hope, that you are going to complete that process one day. One day we will be made wholly new. We thank you for your graciousness. We thank you that you are at work at all in our lives. We thank you for your gentleness. We thank you for your patience. And pray that both your patience and your gentleness will continue. Thank you for your love and your provision for us. Amen.